War Room Impeachment with Stephen K. Bannon, Jason Miller, and Raheem Kassam. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Welcome to War Room Impeachment. It's the 22nd of December, the year of our Lord, 2019. We're live from Capitol Hill, just yards from the nation's capital itself, the Capitol building. A few days ago, the 45th President of the United States was impeached. Episode 85, live on the John Fredericks Radio Network, on Salem Broadcast Radio Network, on AmericasVoice.news, and Newsmax TV, now crossed in 70 million homes under the leadership of Chris Ruddy. Our guest today is Peter Navarro, Assistant to the President for Manufacturing, head of the Manufacturing and Trade Council. And Dr. Navarro, an old and dear friend.
Stephen K.
Harvard PhD. By the way, Dr. Navarro doubles as our sound engineer with the good constant comments. Now, the reason we've got some special guests calling in. We're trying to get Brian Kolfage to call in from West Palm Beach, where he was down with the president and the Turning Points people last night at their annual gala. We Build the Wall. Got an award also later in the show. Jason Trenert from Strategist, one of the hedge fund guys, actually foresaw President Trump coming and what a great economic benefit it would be. And then Steve Cortez, our one and only Steve Cortez, we'll call him from Chicago, the other American economic nationalist, to join Dr. Peter Navarro. Look, one of the reasons, and it was great that we got a Sunday to do this and get you in studio, you never get a chance, even when you go on the shows, is to, and I want to thank the Maria Bartiromo and the crew for giving Navarro the hook so he could actually, you know, we really caught him on his bike ride around the Capitol and just kind of waved him down, waved him down in his workout. You never get a chance.
A little chilly out there.
A little chill. You never really get a chance to go through in detail what the philosophy and back of the Trump economic program is, how you guys developed it, and where we stand on execution. So I want to start at the beginning about the architectonics, right, of what is the Trump economic program. You were brought in, you were early on in the campaign, in early 16, you were laying this out. It was in all the speeches. Quite frankly, when I stepped into the campaign, one of the things, as you know, I sat down with you immediately, was to, I thought that they had gotten off of that. We needed to get more of that into the speeches every day and just hammer home this kind of economic nationalism, and particularly trade, manufacturing, all that. Let me start off with, before you talk, you lay out for us, why are you so focused? You're head of manufacturing and trade. Why is manufacturing and trade so central to President Trump's vision of where the American economy has to go? When you hear the Wall Street guys talk about service jobs and, you know, we're in the 21st century and this is all a throwback to the American system of the 19th century and these guys are a bunch of, you know, dinosaurs. So walk us through what the whole philosophy is and then walk us through how you execute.
It's a pretty quick story, Steve. It's economic security is national security. You can't have a strong United States of America from a military perspective unless you have a strong manufacturing base, which begets a strong defense industrial base. The second reason is simply that these jobs tend to pay more, and plus they have a robust supply chain, which ripples jobs out across the land. In the language of economics, they have what's called a high multiplier effect. And interestingly enough, manufacturing jobs are a key source of employment for those who don't go to college and burden themselves with $1 million worth of student debt. They're the blue collar folks in our flyover states, in our communities, that can earn very good wages, the nobility of working with their hands, building things for America and the world. And as someone once said, sitting close to me here, the Republican Party under President Trump has become the party of the working class. And that's why we focus on manufacturing, Steve.
To walk us through, one of the things you're most controversial about is you're, and the reason I you know, came upon your work many years ago was that you're known as one of the China hawks or the super hawks. Walk us through the manufacturing base. We were the most advanced manufacturing country in the world, the workshop for the world. And all of a sudden, we weren't over a period of 10, 20, 30 years. How did that happen? What were the driving forces in back of it? And where did the manufacturing base actually go?
I'm asked often by journalists the question, how did I get interested in China? Because my background is as a macro economist, forecasting where the economy is going to go and therefore where the stock market's going. I did that for decades. I wrote books about it. What happened in the early 2000s, shortly after China joined the World Trade Organization, I didn't recognize that at the time, but I was teaching at a business school with executive MBAs, and they were fully employed, and I started seeing that they started losing their jobs. And I'm thinking, this is odd. We're in one of the most robust counties in the country. How is this happening? And that began what has turned into a trilogy of books about China, Coming China Wars in 06, Death by China in 2011, Crouching Tiger, which deals with the military end of it. And the at the time when I started looking at this, the default hypothesis was that China was simply a source of cheap labor, end of story. And I found a much more malevolent story. I found a state capitalist model driven by all manner of unfair subsidies. I saw state-owned enterprises acting as national champions. I saw currency manipulation. I saw what would have come to be what I would call the seven deadly structural sins. And as early as 2005, I identified about four of those. And for the United States of America, the devastation was simply that we lost over 70,000 factories, Steve, because of this. Over 5 million manufacturing jobs. And it cut out basically the heart of our manufacturing base. And so when you have a original equipment manufacturer, as they say, go over to China to set up shop there,
The OEMs.
The OEMs. You can't keep the supply chain. The supply chain withers and dies. So combination of NAFTA and China basically gutted this country, just absolutely gutted this country. Donald J. Trump saw it long before anyone. I saw the China thing in 2006. People thought I was stark raving mad, writing a book called The Coming China Wars. They thought it was hyperbole. And today reads like a government report. I mean, so that's how that all happened. And I'm a macro guy first, macro and markets guy first, but you can't really forecast the economy or the stock market without understanding China.
Let's go to the seven deadly structural sins, because that was so much of what this trade agreement really was at the beginning. And then I want to get into the four points of the compass, because I think one leads to the other. What are the seven, when you say the seven deadly sins, and for the audience, of how they have to think of the world economy and this concept of coupling, decoupling, because now this issue has gotten to be a geopolitical issue, and this will define the 21st century of what we're doing here. So walk through the seven deadly structural sins you found, and then I want to talk about the four points of the compass, which is really the Trump reaction to really building a strong, economically viable America.
We have what I would describe as a naive corporate executive core over the last 15 to 20 years, thinking that all countries would play by the same rules that they would play by. And so when you encounter a rival that will do, okay, first, number one, cyber intrusions into our business networks. In other words, China will come in, and you do this with people in military uniforms sitting in Shanghai. It's an organized attack. So you go in to a corporation, small, medium, or large, you hack in, you get inside there, and you can extract all manner of things, including their trade secrets and intellectual property. There's the intellectual property itself, the theft. That's number two. That's on the order of several hundred billion dollars a a year. It's things like ripping off Nikes and brands like that. But it's also sophisticated equipment that they'll steal. And they basically stole the whole solar industry from us. Forced technology transfer, you go over to China. You want to sell into that big bad market, 1.3 billion customers. Well, give us your technology. There's the subsidies themselves and the dumping that comes with it. The state-owned enterprises are a powerful weapon that China
Huge.
Uses. This is the idea where they used to have several national champions. Now what they're doing in this late stage now is consolidating every industry into one big bang national champion. Currency manipulation.
And by the way, in the state-owned industries, in the scale of them, like in steel, they have over half the world's.
You talk about the top 10 corporations in the world, probably seven of them are Chinese.
Right. And this is where their number one export throughout the world is overcapacity and deflation.
Yes.
One of the reasons we have in the West, the industrial democracies, of getting wages up,
yeah.
right? It's almost impossible to get wages up because you have this vast overhang of their overcapacity, and they're always prepared to undercut
yeah.
the price because they pay their workers essentially tantamount to the West slave wages.
And then you have the currency manipulation, which was a really vicious weapon during the mid-2000s. And the last thing is killing us with fentanyl. We lose about 50,000 Americans a year. So what President Trump has done has been a beautiful thing because he has stood tall, even as he's educated both Capitol Hill and the American public on the real China. And the people of America are standing with him. Bipartisan support on Capitol Hill. We're working well now with this phase one deal going, what's going to be a long march essentially to deal with these structural sins. And what I'm looking at in 2020, and I'll give you my forecast free.
Hang on, I want to do that at the after the break.
I'm going to keep sticking around here. Forecast
yes,
is next.
Yes, we're actually going to have. I actually bumped Jason Trenner, who wants to talk to you about that, to the second half of the show.
Yeah.
But I want to go back. I'm trying to do this logically. I know you PhDs at Harvard. Just deal. Let the business school guys on the other side of the river. Let us walk you through this. We know how to make presentations.
I'm trying
okay?
to pivot.
These, no,
I'm
yeah,
trying
exactly.
to pivot no, to the I, forecast. No, make people some money.
No, we're going to do that. But I want to go back.
What's the Trump economy, baby?
Well, let's talk about that. President Trump, and he doesn't get enough credit for this as a businessman, but he actually has a very strong feel for how the world works. Talk to us about the four points of the compass, because this is kind of the underpinnings of his model that he's trying to work through with the Chinese so we have a prosperous future going forward. What are the four points of the compass?
When he says he's a genius, I believe him, because going back, everything stems, Steve, from the DNA of the campaign, everything. And early on in the campaign, we were talking about four points of the economic policy compass. It's basically tax cuts. And if you think about tax cuts, it's primarily you get the bump from the lowering the corporate tax, because that, you could take that from 35 to 21%. That's what gets you the investment back on shore, right? So that's like critical. You get a little Keynesian bump from the personal income tax cut, but the real manna from heaven in that is a corporate tax cut. So that's number one. Number two, deregulation. The president undersold that during the campaign.
Deconstruction of the administrative state.
Indeed. Yes. Please get him out of here.
This is central.
He promised that he would get rid of two regulations for every new one. And it's been he's been eight regulations out for every one. That's a pure Reagan-esque positive supply shock, because it's deflationary, which allows us to grow faster without concern of the Fed, and it's a growth driver. The third thing is,
why is that never? You know, my deconstruction of the administrative state is kind of the overall concept. what President Trump's done practically, you promised 2-for-1. It's at 8-to-1.
It's amazing.
But why is this the second time I've ever heard this? The first time I ever heard it is when I said it last week on TV because you told me about it. And then the second time I ever heard it is right here. Why is the administration not hammering this every day? Because this is, I think this has done more to unlock economic animal spirits than
you are the
cuts.
Hammer with 800,000 downloads on your podcast. Okay. I mean, what better place would you rather do this
and
on
we're giving
the presser on War Room Impeachment?
I'm with it. Okay. Now that you say it that way.
Yeah, now that I say it that way. So the next point.
So we have tax cuts, we have deregulation.
Yeah, we got the third point. This is Hillary Clinton in West Virginia, kind of the alternate universe, right? She goes into West Virginia and says she's going to put all the coal miners out of business, right? What Donald Trump says is like, we're going to unleash our energy sector. And guess what? We're the biggest oil producer in the world. We're exporting oil. What that does is a couple things. For businesses, it gives us global competitive advantage. That's the big thing we have over Europe because they have a very similar economy, but we got the cheaper energy. Also, from consumers' point of view,
huge
it puts
tax
more...
Cut.
It's a tax cut. It's purchasing power.
But here's the intellectual construct difference. It was not energy independence, which a lot of people had yammered about. This was full-spectrum energy dominance in every sector.
Absolutely. And if you look at coal... gas, oil, it's amazing. And yeah, you hear Joe Biden talking about getting rid of fossil fuels in the debate. It's like, that's going to play well in Wyoming and Pennsylvania and Texas. You're talking about putting tens of thousands of people directly out of work and millions out of work indirectly.
When are we going to put nuclear on there?
There's really good work being done over at DOE, Department of Energy, right now, trying to get to the next generation of reactors. There's some promising reactors where you don't have to worry so much about the fuel cycle and all of that in terms of weapons and things like that.
And we're finally going to stop buying our uranium from Russia and start using American.
I'm just trying to get the uranium mines going again. Another one. But the fourth point of the compass is really the mother lode of the Trump administration, and this is fair and balanced trade. And the idea here is that when you run these big trade deficits, because...
Oh, they don't matter.
All my
bettors at Goldman Sachs, they don't matter. This is Navarre and Bannon. Trade deficits. Lou Dobbs is a crank. They don't matter.
Parse this. The arithmetic is pretty simple. $1 billion of trade deficit equals 5,000 jobs. Okay? Scale that up, dude. Scale that up. So when you're shipping off your auto production... to Germany because their tariff is 4 times higher than our tariff. Tell Goldman Sachs that's that's losing jobs in Detroit. I'm sorry. And if you're losing jobs in Detroit, you're losing money, GDP and wages and
how did the
Republican
how did the Conservative Party how did the Republican Party embrace this radical concept of free trade? When it's obvious that China is a totalitarian mercantilist system, even Adam Smith said it couldn't. But I don't understand the mass psychology. Because when this first got brought up, you know, this is what Stephen Miller and Senator Sessions and I talked in the Breitbart Embassy up here in 2013 about trade and immigration being two sides of the same coin about American workers. But when you mention this, people, the free trade guys would go, you guys are essentially, you know, you're communist, right? Because you talk about protectionism, you talk about tariffs. How did the mass psychology of free trade infect the Republican Party?
Steve, you're a man of letters. If you look at kind of what the Republican Party is, it has two strains that often meet, but not always. One is the social conservatism. The other is the libertarian conservatism. And free trade is pure libertarian conservatism. And there's this thought that if you simply open your markets up to the world and you go by the Ricardian model, everybody will be better off. Well, how's that working out? But the multinationals hijacked that Ricardian model, hijacked the Republican Party basically by lubricating the political machinery with their contributions and basically offshoring our jobs.
And so what Trump comes in with is this concept of reciprocity and fair trade, that you have to have. He's a free trader, but in the context of there has to be
revolution, not evolution. It is revolution in the Republican Party.
And what is that? And what did reciprocity and fair trade? I knew we'd won when Ted Cruz took out a fair trade ad in Wisconsin in the primary.
The short tagline is from the president is simply, "We're not going to be anybody's piggy bank anymore.
Right?
We're not going to be anybody's patsy." I mean, you cannot keep sending $500 billion a year of trade deficit offshore and expect good things to happen.
They ship us, China ships us, what, $500 billion of electronics or
it's manufacturing? It's about 5-to-1.
And we ship $100 billion of essentially raw materials in that.
The tariffs are changing that equation. In this phase one deal, they promised to buy $200 billion above the 2017 baseline, so that'll do it.
But the key thing, we got a couple of minutes left in this segment. You actually had a strategy for all trade deals. People in the past, trade had been put in the back. You actually had an architecture.
You got the 4 points of the economic compass from the DNA of the campaign, but you also have the 7 promises on trade, the famous June 26th jobs plan speech outside of Pittsburgh.
Yep.
Everybody should read the transcript of that. Just Google that and read that.
We'll put it up. We're going to put
President
it on the site.
Trump, promises made, promises kept. He has kept every single one of those. And it was granular. Those promises were granular.
Detail, yep.
He promised 232 on steel and aluminum. He promised 301 on China. He promised to renegotiate NAFTA and South Korea. And look, Steve, going into 2020, and when you let me do my forecast in the next segment.
We got a minute left.
You've got trade deals with Japan, South Korea, Canada, Mexico, and China, which is well over half of all our trade.
Oh, it's 75%.
And he got that done. President Trump got that done in 3 years. Any one of those, Steve, any one of those would be an achievement.
Monumental.
In a single term of a presidency, and he's going to get 5 more years, and it's going to be amazing.
Okay, let us take a break. Our guest is Dr. Peter Navarro. He's the assistant to the president for manufacturing trade. We're talking about the economic strategy of Donald J. Trump, the 45th president of the United States. Yes, the same one they got impeached this week by these radical Democrats.
Split-screen presidency.
We're here live on Capitol Hill. You can go to warroom.org. You're going to get to see the speech of the president in June of 2016. We're going to have that up there. And everything else related to the economic policies and strategies of the president. The president just got impeached. Here on War Room Impeachment, Stephen K. Bannon on the John Fredericks, the Salem, the America's Voice, and Newsmax TV. We'll be back in a moment.
War Room Impeachment. Here's your host, Stephen K. Bannon.
Welcome back to War Room Impeachment, live from Capitol Hill. It's 22 December, year of our Lord, 2019. We're episode 85. I'm joined in studio by Dr. Peter Navarro, assistant to the president for manufacturing, head of the Manufacturing Trade Council. Dr. Navarro is a PhD from Harvard. I notice they don't often mention that. You know, it's like the Harvard Mafia is there. God, who's this guy? He's from UC Irvine, didn't he?
Yeah, all they say is that he's the only economist in the world that supports Donald J. Trump.
Trump, exactly. On the John Fredericks Radio Network, Salem.
And the only one who got it right.
Salem Broadcast, America's Voice, and Newsmax TV. We're now joined on the phone by the hedge fund strategist Jason Trenert. Jason, thank you for joining us today. You were the only one of the few guys that put out that statement, I think in the spring of 16, just when people realized that Dr. Navarro was now in the campaign. You went long Trump early on, didn't you, Jason?
We did, Steve. We actually wrote a piece when there was a flirtation with when Donald Trump flirted with being president in 2011. We wrote a piece for Investor's Business Daily about what he was getting right, and you could see the excitement at some of the rallies he had in just that two-week period. We wrote a piece then. Then we wrote a piece actually in August of 2015 saying that Donald Trump was under-owned and that, as you know, no one gave him a chance. And it was pretty clear to me that there was a hunger for his views, particularly as it related to trade and some of the economic issues regarding the middle class.
You know, I want to get to that in a second. You know, on the morning, we won at 2:30 in the morning on the November 9th, 2:30 a.m. AP, Associated Press, called it. Hillary Clinton conceded. We had the speech at what, 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock in the morning or whatever. The global markets are in full meltdown, and Dr. Navarro goes on Squawk Box and gave the the Dow 25,000, and gave the logic to that. Of course, immediately thereafter, Dr. Navarro got the hook from Stephen K. Bannon
me off the air. Thanks.
No, it's when Sorkin of the New York Times goes, they're jumping. He said, "Well, 25,000 is only 10% a year," and he goes, "Well, I would say 30, but then I get trouble." Sorkin goes, "No, don't."
It was
fiasco. So, what did you see, and what do you like today? Because Dr. Navarro is going to talk about forecasts for 2020 here, Jason, with you on.
Yeah.
What do you like about the Trump program, and how do you think it positions us for the future?
Well, listen, I mean, we do it pretty simply when we make our economic and investment forecasts. But we look at monetary, fiscal, regulatory, and trade. And if you looked at those policies, and if you look at them just in a very simple matrix, if you looked at the president's policies regarding those things, versus Hillary Clinton's policies regarding those policies, it was very clear to us what would be better for the markets. And in my opinion, just going quickly, obviously a tax cut, particularly a supply-side tax cut that would stimulate capital spending, huge plus. Becoming energy independent, enormous plus. Deregulation, particularly of the financial markets, and trying to get the velocity of money higher, all of those things are enormously stimulative. The president obviously doesn't have impact per se or directly on monetary policy, but it was also pretty clear to us that monetary policy would remain pretty accommodative. When they did try to normalize rates, of course, and it drives people crazy, the president was right, and the Fed's eased three times this year despite tightening four times last year. But if you look at all those things now, none of those things change, and normally what creates recessions, in my opinion, is inflation, much higher inflation that causes the Fed to kill it. And we're nowhere near that right now.
Let me ask both of you guys where I got you here. Why, with the tax cuts and the way the tax cuts were structured and the whole economic program of trade to bring supply chains back, the one missing element in here that could turbocharge the economy going forward is capital expenditure. So, Jason, I'll ask you first and then Dr. Navarro. Why have we not seen CapEx follow in, given the deregulation, given the structure of the tax cut, given the stability of the economy? I'll go to you first, Jason, and maybe you have. Maybe you've got better numbers than I do, and then I want to get Dr. Navarro.
Well, listen, you might not like the answer, but I think it did turbocharge CapEx last year. For the S&P 500, capital spending was up about 18%. I would argue this year, the trade negotiations with China, in my opinion, and I'm not saying it's not worth having, but it did hurt business confidence. It created some uncertainty regarding business confidence. And also you have to say businesses had to adjust to the fact that there's a new reality with regard to China in terms of dual sourcing their supply lines and all the rest of it. So to me, it's a transition year. To the extent to which China
2019 is a transition year or 2020?
2019 is a transition year. I would say CapEx should pick up back into 2020 now that China's not behind us, but people have a better sense of the state of play with regard to China now. Large companies have a better sense. And listen, the tax cuts are long-lasting.
I agree with most of what you said, but this whole idea that CapEx was down because of uncertainty over China, I think that's Wall Street spin. That's and here's why.
I love Navarro. He's curmudgeonly on everybody.
But no.
Jason, I get it to him all the time.
Hear me out on that, because your analysis was spot on otherwise. But my view is that what President Trump has set in motion is the exodus of the supply chain from China, regardless of what happens. I think that people understand now in the corporate world the risks associated with locating their supply chain there. So the China effect, I think, was muted with respect to CapEx. Don't forget, we were waiting for USMCA to get done. True. That's going to spur a tremendous amount of investment here In the hemisphere.
Well, I've got both of you guys. There's so much we want to get to. Let's go to monetary policy for a second.
Yeah.
Is it the strong dollar? Jason, you first. We have a strong dollar or overvalued dollar? Because I know Navarro's got another radical theory about this.
Well,
the president and Navarro, but yeah, I want to make sure they fully
All my radical theories become mainstream in about 2 years, so be careful, Eric.
Yeah, listen, I'm for free markets, and I think the dollar is appropriately priced right now. If anything, I could see it weaken slightly in 2020. The main thing I don't want to see, or the main thing I was actually happy to see, is that the Fed is being aware of the potential impact it's having on the dollar. In the old days, the Treasury Department focused on dollars and the Fed focused on interest rates. And the Fed would kind of have a benign neglect view of the dollar, generally speaking. In the last 4 years, the Fed learned the hard way twice that it's very difficult to tighten monetary policy or, quote-unquote, normalize monetary policy if you have $12 trillion of negative-yielding debt globally. So the fact that the Fed is aware that its policies could affect the dollar and make it too strong, I don't fear a stronger dollar, but I also don't want it to get
Let me push back a little here, Jason, because first of all, the Fed's awareness is simply because President Donald J. Trump repeatedly banged Jay Powell over the head for raising rates too far, too fast. That's number one. Number two, we're living in a world where there's a significant spread between interest rates here in the U.S. And elsewhere, particularly Europe, and that set up a carry trade, which has inflated the dollar. And third, I urge everybody who's a nerd to read the IMF's external sector report on an annual basis. And on an annual basis, they argue with good analytics that the real effective exchange rate of the United States is double-digit high. It's overvalued relative to where it would be. Now, for your listeners, why does that matter? When you have an overvalued dollar, that makes it harder for us to sell our exports. We buy more imports. Our trade deficit goes up. And the practical reality is we have fewer jobs here, and we're creating jobs over there. So there's no question, if you look at it from pure analytics point of view, that dollar is overvalued.
Okay, let me both you guys. Jason, I want to start with you first, and I'll go to Dr. Navarro. Walk us through, given everything that you see that's happened, the transition year 2019, economy that I think is very strong, what do you look at 2020 in this election year? They've just impeached. You know, our show focuses on his impeachment, also the opportunity cost of his impeachment. With the Democrats, where do you see 2020? And then I'll get Dr. Navarro's ideas.
You know, I have to tell you, Steve, so our clients are institutional investors. I've been to 14 cities over the past 3 months to visit them, everywhere from, Minnesota to Sarasota to California, everywhere. Impeachment, I can tell you, in about 75, 80 meetings, I was just looking at this, impeachment came up 3 times in 80 meetings. And most of the time it comes up when we're walking to the elevator and we're making small talk. For institutional investors, people have viewed this as a sideshow and not something that is changing. It's clear, the markets are telling you, it's not changing their views on what's happening with the markets. People tend to view it, in my view, for what it is, which is largely political revenge, and don't view it seriously. I don't think corporate America either views it that seriously. They could start to take more seriously the fact that the president still has things that are on his list that he's going to take care of, whether it's big tech or what have you. But I think there's more of a recognition right now that barring some exogenous event, President Trump is likely going to be reelected given the economic and financial circumstances that we have right now. And people are getting ready for that.
What the market is telling us, basically. I think the public and the markets have discounted to zero the chance that this noise of impeachment will be successful.
And it will stop. And at some point in time, we're going to get off the opportunity cost and he'll be back to actually, although he just had the two biggest weeks of his presidency, actually get things. So what do you look at?
Let me quickly give you my 2020 forecast and why I think this will happen. I see gross domestic product growth, real GDP, closer to 3% than 2%. That is very, robust in this world. I see a Dow. I predicted Dow 30,000 if USMCA got passed and the Fed lowered interest rates. I see Dow easily over 30,000, as much as 32,000. But the NASDAQ will outperform the Dow because Boeing headwinds. We've got the Supermax problem there, but we've also now got some issues with their space division. But that's going to be robust, solid growth. We got Keynesian drivers. Last night, the president signed the NDAA and the appropriations bill, which is going to be a straight, solid Keynesian stimulus through 2020, along with the tax cut, which has been in place. And then we got the structural drivers that Jason mentioned, which is the deregulation, which is the gift that keeps on giving, the cheap energy that comes out of that. And then all these trade deals are going to start kicking in, and they'll have initially an investment component like USMCA, and then they'll have a production component as we begin to export more. And then we've got the micro drivers. One thing I love about President Trump, every day he gets up thinking about how to create good jobs for Americans who work with their hands. So at the micro level, we're doing things like arms defense transfer policies, which are building more F-16s to sell to the world so there's plants in South Carolina. We're taking care of our shipyards in places like Philadelphia, Marinette, Wisconsin, down in the panhandle of Florida. We are taking care of our combat vehicle plants in places like Lima, Ohio, and York, Pennsylvania. And the steel tariffs themselves have been working beautifully to induce literally billions and billions of dollars in the country. So from a micro and a macro viewpoint, I see a tremendous stimulus in 2020 coupled with a consumer, because of the low unemployment rate, is seeing fat paychecks and has high confidence about job security, and they will spend.
I want to bring in now Steve Cortez. Steve Cortez is was a member of the Trump campaign in 2016. He was a CNN contributor, also a hedge fund guy, one of the most brilliant guys, and now has a new radio show in Salem out in Chicago. Steve, thank you very much for joining us to this conversation. Steve's also a Wall Street guy. We've got Jason Trennert from Strategist, Steve Cortez, and we're joined in studio by Dr. Peter Navarro. Jason, let me go to you. Given what Dr. Navarro just said, is this the year that we additionally get turbocharged by additional capital expenditure? Is this where they say, hey, you put China to bed, and you know, maybe Bannon and some of the super crazies aren't totally happy with it, but the president's done a great job. You got round one done. Navarro and Lighthouse are on round two. Is this where CapEx kicks in and turbocharges us?
Well, I think so. And again, if you just think about the GDP equation, right, so consumer spending, capital spending, government spending, and net exports, it's hard to fade the economy going into 2020. I mean, one of the things I agree very much with Dr. Navarro, I mean, one of the things about the consumer that is not talked about often is not only do you have a low unemployment rate, not only do you have wages up, the savings rate right now is 8%. So the U.S. consumer is very robust to any sort of potential shock.
Donald J. Trump.
Very different from my lifetime. Where
it's unbelievable. Never gets talked about. Cortez, let me bring you in for a second on Trent's part. You've done the best job of outlining the strivers. These are the people that put Donald Trump in office, and the world is on fire with him. Walk through with Trenner's thing nobody talks about. The savings rate's up, the consumer debt package is down. Walk us through the strivers, Cortez.
Right. Now, so, you know, the strivers, the aspirational economic class in this country, blue-collar people, people who maybe don't have advanced degrees, minorities, people who did not participate in the slow growth Obama years, are now taking the lead in this economic expansion. So it's fantastic news. It's important for our country. And one reason I think it's important, Steve, and I make this point all the time, populist nationalism is here. It is not going away. It is not a fad. It's a structural change. It is either going to come from the left or from the right, because the working class has had it. They've had it with globalist elites abusing them. What we're showing, though, is that populist nationalism from the right is the effective and successful policy set for them. And the fact that right now, in terms of income gains, blue collar is outpacing white collar in terms of income growth. Everybody's doing better, but they're doing the best. Minorities doing better than whites, less educated compared to college degrees. All of this shows us that the strivers just needed to have the shackles taken off. They needed fairer trade deals. We needed tax and regulatory relief so small business could explode in this country. And most of all, manufacturing. We don't have final numbers yet for 2019, but for 2018, it was the best manufacturing year for job growth since the 1990s. We'll probably surpass it this year. That's fantastic news for the strivers in this country.
Jason Turner, before I go back to Dr. Navarro, when you went around to the institutional investors, do you think the institutional investors get the breadth and depth of the Trump economic revolution?
I do. I have to say it's taken some time. And to be fair, most of our clients kind of skew Republican, right? Probably 60 to 70% of them skew Republican. But not all of them are big supporters of the president. But I think more and more there is absolutely no question, especially with regard to China, that popular opinion and, quote unquote, for lack of a better term, elite opinion has changed dramatically, which is to say that two years ago, the idea of having a trade war with China was seen as anathema to a lot of people. And now there's just been a complete reevaluation of what that meant, why it was necessary, why it's going to continue to be necessary. So I think that there's, in terms of President Trump's economic agenda in total, I think people are understanding that it's a little bit more coordinated among those four policies I was talking about, monetary, fiscal, regulatory, trade. It's a little more, probably a little bit more coordinated than people had thought it might.
Hey, don't forget energy and immigration.
Energy and immigration. The last thing before I let you two guys go is that Cortez, this is the reason that they impeached him. Because if you take the Michigan rally and next day the market's on fire, it's that combo. It's what Trenet's talking about and what Cortez is talking about. It is the strivers. He can speak in a non-political vernacular and deliver for people, working class people, middle class people, and sophisticated guys like Trenet and the institutional investors understand now what the program is. That's why it's on fire. That's why they know this is a stable economy. It's the strivers that provide the stability to a nation. Right. That allows the investing class to say, okay, we can put capital to work, and that is when you get into a virtuous circle. That's why this is on fire. That's why they have to impeach him. He's an existential threat to the opposition party and to the radical left of the Democratic Party.
Right. You're exactly right, Steve, because he understands value creation, right? And that's what we see in the stock market. He's sophisticated enough to understand capital markets and value creation, but he's also authentic enough to speak with authority and with a genuine outreach to the strivers out there, who again are also feeling that it wouldn't be enough to just appeal to them, to just communicate well to them. They're also seeing it at the kitchen table. They know that their wages are rising dramatically, and it's an era of low inflation. So it's really the best of all worlds for working class Americans right now. And we see that, for example, in the housing market, which is on fire in this country. I'm a data dork, so I dig into some of this stuff. The Architectural Billings Index, probably something most listeners haven't heard of, but it's important. That has soared the last couple of months. What that means is a lot of people are asking for designs and architecture plans for building. That's a pipeline issue. That takes months to come, which tells me that 2020 construction is going to be on fire in this country. So these are the kind of real-world ramifications of smart policy. And President Trump, because he's implementing these policies and because the Democrats know they cannot beat him at the ballot box, they're trying to mortally wound him in impeachment, and which it won't work, but that's what they're trying.
I want to give the last word to Dr. Navarro, who's one of the architects of this with President Trump or President's policies. You get the last word, Dr. Navarro.
President Trump is going to deliver a beautiful economy for 2020, and it all springs from the DNA of that campaign. It's the 4 points of the policy compass. It's the 7 promises on trade as his jobs plan speech. And there has never been a president who has kept his promises like this president. So 2020, we're going to have solid economic growth. We're going to have a solid stock market. And the working class, who have now moved over to the Republican Party, are going to outperform others in this economy. But everybody's going to win.
I want to thank our guest today, Dr. Peter Navarro, the assistant to the president, head of manufacturing and trade, in the tip of the spear when it comes to assisting the president in his trade policies and his economic policies. Jason Trenard, the first hedge fund, really the hedge fund strategist, the hedge fund guru, to really predict and know that President Trump's policies would come in. He's a strategist. And, of course, Steve Cortez on the campaign in 2016 is going to be one of the great on the Hispanic Advisory Council, one of the smartest hedge fund guys around. Now has a radio show on Salem out of the Chicago area, soon to be nationwide. It's a fantastic show. This is Stephen K. Bannon. We're in impeachment. Remember, we'll be back live tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. And just a historical note. In 1944 at Bastogne, this was the day that General McAuliffe told the Nazis nuts. It's also the day in, I think, 1864 that Savannah was delivered to the President Lincoln on the road to end the March to the Sea and the end of the Civil War. Historic day. We'll see you tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. on War Room Impeachment.